Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. Although we might change the title of the show to Visionary Organizer, guided by our guest, Astra Taylor, whom I will bring in moments. So we are in the last day of Fund Drive for the Visionary Activist Show, so a rousing turnout for our place of convening and, yes, organizing, all right, on the air and off the air. So, there are many wonderful gifts for anybody who gives anything, the telling the story. We will be doing dedicated pitching with wonderful Chris Welsh at the very end of the hour. As our indefatigable, wonderful KPFA Skookum guide says, doing a great interview with Astra Taylor will be good. The coyote trick, get their ears and get their pledges. Just joking. She says we would need to focus right now to reach our overall goal of $450,000. That would be good. The goal for this hour is $2,000. We can do this. We can do it as in the old days. This show's been on the air for 25 years. Holy moly. Same as Democracy Now!, but they work harder, get up earlier, and do it every day. So this is Democracy Now! On mushrooms, the Entheo version. So we will be pitching. There's a match, a $700 match from Valerie from McKinville, Oregon, and Lee from Santa Cruz. So you can have that, contribute to that match by calling 1-800-439-5732 or pledging securely online at kpfa.org. So, yes. So we welcome ally of deep delving erudition and liberating lucidity, Astra Taylor, hosted her once before. That was Fun Drive 2. We're going to do another show when it's not, but we like this, whose latest offering is Remake the World. Previous book, Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone. She is a Canadian-American documentary filmmaker, writer, activist, and musician. She's a fellow of the Shuttleworth Foundation for her work on challenging predatory practices around debt. She is inspiring us all to be better informed, dedicated to deep delving, effective contribution to collective well-being. You can find her on Twitter at Astra Disastra. Oh, this is fun. And also a really great website, hiddendriver.com. It's the creative home of Laura Hanna and Astra Taylor, who use every medium at their disposal: documentary, animation, the written word, activist campaigning, and ethical spectacle making. Yes, liberating cultural hijinks to better understand the world, connect with others, and challenge the status quo. Welcome, Astra.
Thank you so much for having me on again. And I just want to say congratulations on 25 years. So I am going to donate my $25 because it's so important to keep shows like yours on the air, and to know that we, the listeners, are the people who are behind the shows, who are funding them, so that they will actually be interesting and important and visionary.
Right. And as you've reframed language so wonderfully well, you know, it's like it's not an audience, it's participants.
Yes.
We have a dedicated, dynamic listening audience. I hear from you every week. I want to hear from you in a tangible way. Again, you can pledge any amount and get the Telling the Story archives, and then there's a whole list of fun things you can get. But really, it's the show, and it's Astra, and it's voices like this that we need so much. So, there's, again, democratic show, Astra, wherever you want to go is completely great. But I did, in the first chapter of, you know, Remake the World, you know, breathing together and conspiracy, right? Conspiro, to breathe together. And I did send you a little note saying, I find it charming that in sumo wrestling, the referee will not begin the match until the two opponents are breathing together. Isn't that kind of fun? So, yeah, and then yes, the inhaling of language. So conspiracy, you know, became, a dark, bad thing. Do you want to, maybe we can inhale it back in as positive intrigue?
Yes, I do love to find, to learn this sort of hidden meanings of the words we use every day. So I guess I'm kind of an etymology buff.
Yes.
And I knew the word inspiration, of course, means to, you know, breathe, right? To inhale, to inspire. And it was quite a revelation for me to learn that conspiracy, as you just wonderfully pointed out, is to breathe with others, right? So to conspire, it's breathing together. And if you go back to the original meaning of the word, back to the Latin, it also means to ally, to form a union, right? So this, it's not just the breath, but the connection, right? People being allies and forming unions. And, you know, that's quite striking because when we talk about conspiracy theories today, we had Donald Trump in office. He was kind of the conspiracist in chief, you know, very destructive misapprehensions of the way power works. So, you know, people often very anti-Semitic, speculating that there's a kind of, you know, all powerful sect pulling the strings. They control everything. It was quite interesting for me then to learn that actually there's this whole other way you can reframe the word. And it, well, again, it has this beautiful original meaning, but that actually, if you go back to the founding of this country, one of the many laws that we imported from British common law was the conspiracy doctrine. And essentially, the conspiracy doctrine was the doctrine used to suppress people from becoming allies and forming unions. It was the doctrine that was used to attack workers, whether they were tailors or shoemakers or hat makers, who were trying to agitate for labor rights, for higher wages, for lower, you know, less working hours, you know, a 12-hour day, some time off, you know, just the basic subsistence that they deserved. And basically the powerful said, oh, this is a terrible conspiracy. You know, you're charged with the conspiracy doctrine. And so union organizing, you know, was basically outlawed. It was illegal for people to come together, to breathe together. And so, you know, The essay traces the fact that the long and violent suppression of the left, of people coming together to form unions, is why we are now in this situation where inequality is spiraling, where wildfires are burning, so we're choking, we can't breathe, where there's, you know, racist police violence, where, you know, we hear this chant in the streets, I can't breathe. It's because, you know, it's partly because of this long history of bashing and destroying and sabotaging the left using the conspiracy doctrine. And so that the essay is, you know, really about, like everything I do, the importance of organizing, the importance of understanding that, you know, there are powerful people who don't want us to come together, and they write many of the laws that we are governed by unjustly, and that we need a conspiracy of epic proportions in order to create a more egalitarian world.
And I love that the utopian Fourier said, in any ideal community, we must allow for the passion for positive intrigue, right? So we want to take these spicy words back, conspiracy, intrigue, and, you know, and also the, you know, liberating cultural hijinks. I do think of you as elevating public discourse. And it's true, reading this book, Remake the World, it does what reading should do. It's like, I want to be a better person. I want to know more. I am inspired by Astrid Taylor to delve ever more deeply. That's so wonderful. And yeah, we share a love of etymology. I like privilege comes from privilege, private law. And we go, there you have it. There you have it. That's right there. It's in the word. It's right there. You know, and just for the fun of it, inaugurate comes from the augur, who would be the diviner within all of us, who would walk out into nature and read nature's, you know, patterns, whereby who would be the good enough person to be inaugurated. Anyway, so everything's got meaning.
I love it. Yeah, and thank you for the kind words about my work. I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, it's great. From start to the breathing to Out of Time with Greta Thunberg, you know, and everything. And I've read it, and I'm going to go back over. I had so many notes, I might as well have just underlined the whole book. So, yeah, because there's so many, each little thing, you know, what you do so well to tease it. Like, you know, in the breathing chapter, you say, you know, under socialism, we would have to prioritize experimenting, collectively thinking and working these and other challenges through. Experimentation, yeah, let me toss it back to you, but as an essential part of democracy. Does that work for yourself?
It does. I mean, I hope experimentation is an essential part of human existence and creativity and just an important part of being in the world. But experimentation, is essential to think about it as part of democracy, because the fact is, we're figuring out not just how to do democracy, make it work, but really what it is. Because if you look back on the history of democracy, this concept keeps not just expanding in the sense that, previously marginalized, oppressed, excluded groups fight for inclusion. And that has been what's motored what we call democracy, right? So at the founding of this country, only a very small subset of white men with property could exercise their political rights, could vote, right? If we even take that very limited conception of democracy. So the political subject has expanded thanks to hard work and people giving their lives to fight for a more inclusive society. But through that process of inclusion, of expanding the demos, the people who are part of democracy, democracy has been transformed, right? It's in many ways not recognizable to the people who were around over two centuries ago and founding founding this nation. And so that, we keep we have to keep experimenting and organizing or activism, and those terms are really related. I do distinguish them, but they're definitely two words I really value and practices I really value. It's a process of experimentation because it's quite easy to come up with a 10-point plan. It's quite easy to come up with a list of solutions or things that you'd like to see or policies you'd like to enact. The real creative, gnarly challenge is, how do you do it? How do you actually, get people on board? How do you call attention to injustice while also inspiring people and making them feel that it's worth their time to participate in changing things? And of course, as you proceed and try to reach towards your proposals, your 10-point plan, there's always going to be new information. There's always going to be something that you learn along the way, something that makes you rethink. And then in that sense, you have to be ready for all the things an experiment entails, which is you have to be ready to fail or go down a path where, that turns into a dead end and reassess and learn from your errors. I mean, so it's a very, I think having that attitude of, there's no guarantee. And in an experiment, you learn from the failures as much as you learn from the successes, ideally. And you have to be open to the things you didn't know and possibilities that are beyond your, initial apprehension. And so that is just, I think, a very important ethos to have, not just for democracy at large, but for the organizing that expands and protects the democracy we have and that we want to have.
Yes, and then you take on this crucial issue about you say it's the conspiracy is the first resort of winners. Excuse me. The powerful have claimed to be victims since the founding of this nation. The lies peddled by Trump and the Grand Old Party are just the latest iterations of the truth destroying state building ideologies of yore. Yeah, no, I think here's another wonderful etymology. Delusion comes from deludo, which is out of the game, right? So what is the antidote to delusional, bamboozlement? And how do we brew the antidote to being deluded? And you have a lot to say about that. And maybe you can help me too by a succinct definition of neoliberalism. I every now and then in your writing, I was like, I almost got it. I almost have it. But anti-New Deal, anti-social programs. But how do you define neoliberal?
The most useful definition of neoliberalism for me, or way of understanding it, is that it's not just the dominance of markets, which it certainly is, but it's actually, so it's not as simple as just being pro-market versus the state, right? So it's not as simple as just saying we want things to be privatized and not public. What neoliberalism does is it actually captures the state and uses the state to advance market projects and to insulate the markets from democratic influence, let alone democratic control. Excellent. So it's a way of and I think that the way that the state is insulated is really important. And so that's why you see it in these international trade organizations, right? Like the World Trade Organization, the WTO, or the International Monetary Fund, and then these things called investor-state dispute settlements, or ISDSs, where basically private companies can sue sovereign governments if they feel their profits are being impinged. And there's basically no democratic lever, right? There's no way for citizens, for people on the ground, to influence these institutions. They're so insulated. And so they're quasi-state entities, but there's just, we have no power over them, essentially. And so I think that's where it is. It's not just good old-fashioned privatization, though that's part of it. It really is a kind of, private capture of the state. So the other thing about neoliberalism that is, I think, coming into the conversation more is that where the state capacity is put to use, it's typically for punitive and violent work, right? So there are lots of public prisons. And we're seeing that with Black Lives Matter now, just the emphasis on with the astonishing proportion of state and local budgets that go to policing instead of care work. So violence work is supported by the state because that protects private property, that protects the powerful. But all of the things that we need a state to do, all of the things that make our lives more secure and help us not just survive but thrive. So teaching, healthcare, these things are always defunded. These things are always, we're forced to pay for them ourselves, right? So that's another attribute of neoliberalism that I think is really critical. In a way, the state is, it's not like it's withered the state away. The state's huge, but it's a militarized state. It's a state that emphasizes the work of violence over the work of care.
Yes, right. That's good. That's good because somebody who's probably a neoliberal said, "What is neoliberalism and why is liberalism bad?" And it's like, I have to talk to Astra Taylor and, and hand you that paragraph there. That's really, useful. And then just, you go into a liberating narrative about, how do people get snookered? And I think it's into a cult. And you do mention, I've forgotten his name, someone saying, if the government had said, everybody, here's $20,000 to stay home, that would be fine, which is such a sane, reverent, common sense thing that is like, because otherwise it didn't make any sense at all. So we're putting these sane, reverent, common sense, things on the table, too late for the $20,000 now. But did other governments paid their workers to stay home? Yeah.
Yeah. Other governments did that. The you're referring to a man. I'm not sure I use his name in the essay because I'm not sure. It was a man who was in a local news report, and this was in the early months of the pandemic, right? So last year, so the spring of 2020, and he was in Kalamazoo, Michigan. So it was a clip from the local news, and he was defying the order to close his business. And he basically said, I can't afford to. And he said, everybody should have just gotten money to close up shop and survive, right? But I can't, we don't live in a world where that happened, not to the degree that it needed to. I mean, people got stimulus checks, they got unemployment insurance if they were able to actually, get through the bureaucracy. And he basically said, but I'm not going to just close my restaurant and destroy my economic prospects alone. But what was striking, and as you say, that seems he was right to that point. But then it, what he essentially says is he kind of uses this rhetoric that clues in that he's been seduced by the right wing. So he talks about how he's living under tyranny and patriots shouldn't subject themselves to this. And again, what I'm saying in that essay is part of why the people who are in his position are gravitating towards these frameworks is because the left has been obliterated. He's not encountering other frameworks, right? He's not getting, you know, he's not, he hasn't had his life being part of a community organization or, you know, these sorts of civic associations or unions that give people a different framework for understanding reality. And so, you know, he's right that something is deeply amiss and that this, the course that our government took was, you know, unfair, especially in light of the corporate bailouts that happened last year. I mean, it's almost been forgotten that we gave trillions of dollars to the, you know, we gave vast sums to the private sector. We bought up all of these toxic corporate bonds, right? Even for the fossil fuel industry. And basically, we rewarded companies who had mismanaged their assets. I mean, they'd over-leveraged themselves. So, and the Fed steps in and buys all their bad corporate debt while leaving regular people, you know, with some crumbs, right? You know, and so that's, for me as an organizer, it's just this painful thing where you're like, gosh, if only we had the capacity to actually organize in this moment, because there is a kind of populism. That's the word that was tossed around a lot during the Trump years, right? Where people are rightly angry, but they're misdirecting their anger in really destructive ways that, you know, I find terrifying.
Right. And so to be able to step into the conversation, right, to step into the center going, yes, yes, absolutely, and then here's where you go. I don't know if you saw Bernie Sanders some years back. It was after the 2016 debacle, but it was a town hall, and he was talking to a woman, and even the audience was booing her about, you know, just saying sort of racist and terrible things, but he invited her on stage and then said, well, do you like your Social Security? Yes, 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 yes. And he gently guided her. It was a profound moment. He guided her in which she said, oh, I just voted for the wrong person, I see. But it was so deft, you know, and that's the quality, again, I think, that you're, you know, encouraging in us all to step into the story and be informed and be liberating guides, going, here you go, right? Because it does seem a part of our conversation. How do we spiral, and you're so good at this, spiral out of polarity, you know, and, you know, I like Druid Ally says, you know, if you want people to get nothing done but conflict, convince them they're on one side of something. What two needs, you will only get heat, right, in an already too hot world. What two needs is three, which is the unifying story. Like, here we go. Here we go. And that does, you know, cross borders. There are conversations, if we dissolve the, you know, even the word Republican and Democrat, you know, into a larger discourse, which is also, what is it to be a citizen in a democracy, and what is it to be a citizen, you know, of the earth? And that seems really at the heart of much of your work, right?
It's interesting. There's I think in our neoliberal era, but, you know, basically our kind of advertiser driven era, there's this conception almost that democracy is just the poll, right? The poll results. So we're always, you know, 66% of Americans think this or 33% think that. And it's this data driven snapshot of what people think now. And I suppose, you know, I have a different view, which is that the demos, the people, is, you know, is something, again, it's evolving, it's transforming. And our, you know, work as organizers is to change people's responses to some of those polls, to get them thinking differently, to have them, you know, imagine that things could be different and ideally much better, and to see the demos is something that's in process. And so, yeah, deliberation, being open to people changing and changing their views as they're exposed to new ideas and new experiences and new realities is just something, you know, that is at the heart for me of what it means to be political. I'm thinking now of Jane McAlevey, who is a brilliant labor organizer and writer, and I was really honored when she actually blurbed this essay collection. And she's, you know, she says, you know, it's not organizing if you're not talking to people who don't already agree with you, right? Because we're trying to build a mass. We're trying to get other people on board, and so that for me, it just has to be part of that. It's, you know, the and you have to be that means though, and this connects to another essay in the book that's called The Right to Listen, it doesn't mean that you just tell people what they should think instead of what they think. You actually have to listen to people. Jane McAlevey is also great on this. She says, you know, the mark of a good organizer is that they listen well. You know, it's not about just beating people over the head with the right analysis or with your 10-point plan or whatever it is, but really, figuring out where people are, hearing them, and then, yeah, offering this other way of seeing things and putting them in relationship with others so then they can actually act on those new insights and wield power. And that's why, for me, organizing is so important. Institution building, you know, it's not just talk.
Right. You know, and then part of the to throw liberating lightning at the traps of, as you know, approve, do you approve or disapprove, which is like, no, it does, and that also ties into your chapter on security that I want to hand back to you in a moment. Yeah, right to listen. That's right. We have two ears, one mouth. Is someone's quote from your book, right? It's like, yeah, and I love the very human part in which you said, yeah, we're all learning to listen, and I want to listen to you. But the realm of security and being observed and approval, disapproval. You know, the increasing thing, right? After you've bought something or gone somewhere, you get a little thing going, how was your experience? Or it comes on and goes, you know, after some disheartening thing, I think with Comcast or something, they're like, would you hire the person you just talked to? And I don't want them to get fired. Anyway, so I like not replying. I don't want to approve or disapprove. And yes, I would hire that unhappy, incompetent person. So buzz off and leave her alone. There is that. But security, yes, safety. You know, all life deserves safety, you know, a womb, flower pot, you know, a dead-end street, you know. But take us into your really great, because there's the authentic, right, and then the toxic security of the, you know, the cameras installed in the apartment building. And I think those people successfully defeated that plan, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad that you asked me about this essay because it's actually one of my favorites, and I haven't gotten to talk about it very much. So, you know, this collection of essays is, they, I guess, kind of dance around the themes that interest me, and so that is organizing and activism and technology. I wrote a book called The People's Platform that came out in 2014 about the internet and its relationship to economics and politics. And so the book has quite a few technological pieces and then a bit about climate and the more than human world. But that's something I'm hoping to get into and think about more in the years ahead. But this piece came to me because I was thinking about capitalism, which is another thing I like to think about. And, you know, we tend to think of capitalism as an economic system that is all about profits. So it produces goods and services, and those are commoditized and profits are accumulated. And I was thinking about how that in order to do that, there's another product that has to be created, and that's insecurity. People have to, people cannot be secure, or at least it's less profitable if they are secure, because people, you know, we see this, right? We see the way bosses want their employees to feel vulnerable. You know, somebody else might take their job, or perhaps immigrants are ready to take their jobs, or perhaps the factory is going to be moved overseas where labor is cheaper, or maybe a robot is going to take your job, right? So workers are always on edge. They are forced to compete or forced to feel that they must compete with others to just, you know, keep that wage that they depend on to live. We know so many people are housing insecure, people are food insecure. And so insecurity is not just it's not just a random byproduct. It's really essential to the system. And of course, it has a psychological component too, right? We feel that. One reason I'm so committed to organizing around indebtedness and fighting to cancel debts is that debt has horrible psychological consequences. I mean, it makes people sick and sort of mind and body because, you know, so there are these psychological effects as well. And so I was just thinking that another way of understanding capitalism is to think of it as an insecurity machine, that this is actually fundamental. And so in the ways that, you know, in the spirit of thinking about words, I started looking back at concept of security. And of course, you know, of course, human beings have always been insecure, right? We're vulnerable mortal creatures. And so in the sort of beginnings, you know, so that's just the human condition. The question is, how does capitalism exacerbate that? And how does technology, sort of digital capitalism, make things even more intense? So, you know, security at its roots means without care. That was sort of the original meaning, right? To just actually have no worries. But what was striking to me is that the word insecurity is modern, that it's only a couple hundred years old. And insecurity is a concept that, a word and a concept that emerged with the development of industrialization and capitalism. And so that is a kind of modern condition, right? Just like, you know, enemy is, right? It's not an ancient habit of mind or... So I thought that was kind of fascinating. And I, you know, there's something about also in our language that was also striking to me, in the fact that we now use the language of securities to literally talk about property, right? A security deposit is the deposit you pay your landlord. We talk about securitizing things, you know, and then trading them on the stock market. So we've completely melded the language of security with the language of economics. In a way that I think is worth pointing out. And so, you know, the point of that essay is just that I think as much as we need to focus on eliminating inequality, so economic inequality, the massive divide between the rich and the poor, I'd also really like to think about eliminating insecurity as much as possible, right? And that if we had the things that would make us secure as human beings, right? Housing, food, community,
air,
water. The right to a decent retirement, air, clean water, exactly. Well, we sure would be a lot less exploitable.
Right. No, the priesthoods always trade on fear. No, that's so great, yeah, because I have many, many things underlined. And just to repeat what you just said, the word insecurity did not exist until 17th century capitalism. I'm just keeping that on an index card. Right, that's so important, you know. And then you write what we've said, but I want to say it again, you know, instead of paying workers to stay home to slow down the disease, a sensible life-saving policy pursued in various ways by some wealthy countries, including Denmark, U.S. officials handed trillions of dollars of public money to the world's biggest corporations. Right, this is what gives people, you know, conniption fits and sort of scoots them into cults, right? For the CEOs of these companies, the outbreak has been less a crisis than an opportunity. Not only did they receive a staggering no strings attached government handout, but they also have a more pliable and profitable workforce. When the pandemic passes, millions of people will be even more insecure and exploitable than they were at the outset. This will not be an accident, you write. Capitalism is an insecurity machine, the way we rarely think of it as such. It goes on. But anyway, but I think these are useful. Just everybody hang on. Capitalism is an insecurity machine. It's designed, you know, in a sense, that way to suck the chi out of autonomy. Is that part of?
Well, especially in California, where the land of Silicon Valley, you know, they love to pretend they're doing the opposite. I mean, so I'm thinking about how, and I write about this in that piece, you know, gig workers got organized, you know, and I want to shout out the amazing group Rideshare Drivers United, which is a group of Uber and Lyft drivers founded by folks in Los Angeles, but I believe statewide and maybe even beyond, and who's, you know, started organizing, even though they're not allowed to because they're technically, you know, contract workers, right? Not full-time employees, but they started organizing nonetheless and managed to, you know, work with elected officials and pass AB5, which would have reclassified them and said, hey, guess what? A gig worker is actually just a worker. And of course, DoorDash and Uber and Lyft, you know, put and their associates spent over $200 million to overturn that with Prop 22. And, you know, the goal of that legislation is to keep people precarious, right? It's not about liberating workers. It's not about the fact that being a freelancer is cool and free. It's about, you know, denying people the basic protections, even a minimum wage and the right to organize. And so now you see New York, where I live, you know, trying to implement something sort of like that basically creates a second class category of workers at the state level. And it's because, you know, the last thing these companies want is a workforce that's secure in its rights and has the right to organize and has the right to push back and has the right to a minimum wage. And so that's, you know, you see it right there. You know, it is indeed about accumulating profits, but it's also about creating a certain sensibility in the workers, a certain insecurity. And you see that I talk in the essay, you know, about the sort of beginnings of capitalist enclosure. So going back to the, you know, 14th, 15th centuries, going back to England, and people were kicked off of the commons. The commons were the fields and the forests where people were allowed, they had common rights. They were allowed to use those natural resources to survive, right? Even if they didn't own them themselves, right? In the sense of a kind of private ownership. And so people were made insecure. They were cut off from the livelihood, from their subsistence. And so in order to, you know, in order to turn people from, you know, sort of farmers living off the land into workers who need a wage, you first have to create the condition of insecurity and wagelessness, right, that necessitates that they need to sell their labor to survive. So it's interesting to see these old dynamics anew, you know, with these, you know, supposedly high-tech technologies, right? But really it's just old wine in new bottles.
Right, and the insecurity of, and the commons, of course, you know, is now extending. You know, I like to say democratic animism now to a world of, you know, flora, fauna, humans kicked off of the commons. You know, and you address this in your tree article, tree essay in this book, Remake the World, as well. But I go back to ancestral mentor Dionne Fortune in World War II when she was asked, you know, when will the war end? And she says, can't tell you when, we'll tell you how. It will end when the conditions that gave rise to it are addressed. We go, right. Mm-hmm. You know, when will the pandemic end? It will end when the conditions that gave rise to it are addressed, which is it's the last 5 minutes of the movie Contagion, right, which is genius. It just shows, you know, trees, jungles coming down, animals fleeing, bat pooping on pig slaughtered, taken into kitchen, chef wiping his bloody hands on apron, steps out front to shake hands with Gwyneth Paltrow, and there we go. So it is, you know, what we do to the world, what we do to our human community. So it is all part of that. As you know, all honor to our teammate Greta Thunberg, whom you bring up repeatedly, and also at the very end essay on We're Out of Time. You know, and we're almost out of time. I want to have you back. This is like a little preamble kind of a thing, Astra Taylor. But in our, before I then do dedicated pitching to keep the KPFA alive and the Visionary Activist Show alive, and but actually you're not Nashville, North Carolina. You said you're in New York, right?
I'm in Nashville, North Carolina now, but I do live in New York most of the time.
That's great.
So my
just because I
here,
saw so. That you pledged. Yep. I saw that you pledged. Yeah. That's adorable. She was being interviewed and whatever, and she pledged. Thank you, Astra and Nashville, for $25 pledge. That's wonderful. And there's some other people to thank, which we will as well. But it's so rich. I mean, I have a giant volume of things. Yes, faux security. I mean, all of that. Yeah, the toxic mimic. Building a more secure world for everyone will be a challenge, but it's a risk we have to take, right? We want to be, and that comes back to so much of your points, you know, to take risks. We want, you know, we like safety and we like risk. We want to be safe enough to take the interesting risks, to have that sense of embrace and support. So building a more secure world. Well, I'm rushing at the end here. We've got 5 minutes. We can do this. But you go into the dads of tech. That's I'm scrolling through my the automation charade. Right, the Jefferson dumbwaiters. All right, there we go. The Luddites who actually were who were dissed. You know, again, that's a sneaky part of language, isn't it? Like the word dilettante 100%. Is a good mm-hmm. thing. It means to take delight in. So maybe just who speaks for the trees, the tree that owns itself? Do you want to say a little bit about that?
So I grew up in Athens, Georgia, which is a sweet little college town, known for its music, for bands like R.E.M. and the B-52s. And it had another celebrity, the tree that owned itself. And it was this beautiful tree on a kind of old-fashioned neighborhood near downtown. And this tree had a little plaque, and I quote it at the beginning of this essay, but essentially the plaque says, you know, this tree owns itself for all time. And this just captivated me, right? Because in our paradigm, in our Western capitalist paradigm, you know, the more than human world is typically, but other forms of life are treated as things and can be held as property. So this just planted, you know, I guess a seed, a little acorn in my mind when I was a young kid. And I was very, you know, interested then when I learned many years later that some communities in the United States were actually fighting to rewrite their sort of county or city charters to incorporate the rights of nature. And this is something that was worked into, I believe, the Constitution of Ecuador. So basically, you know, the more than human world, these aren't things, right? That this is there's something else going on here, and that what we should do is give rights to ecosystems and to non-human animals. And so I reported on a community in Pennsylvania that had taken this approach with the guidance of some radical lawyers. And what they did was they passed a charter saying that their local watershed had rights, and that therefore the gas and electric company that was trying to create an injection well, which is basically where fracking, right. It's after fracking, you have to bury your toxic waste somewhere, right? They used it to they've basically managed for 6 years to prevent their community and their local watershed from being destroyed. So you're seeing this around the world in New Zealand, but also in Ohio, Lake Erie. Toledo was recently granted rights. And I love it as an environmentalist. I love it as an organizer because it's actually a strategy that's working. It's managing to throw sand in the gears of these fossil fuel companies. And I love it because to me it is reflective of reality. Right? We're not the only beings in this game. And so I really do think that if we want to have a sustainable democracy, if we want to have a democracy that lasts, we're going to have to create ways of accounting for beings that go beyond just us, right? Because we're all interconnected, we're all interdependent, we are embedded in these larger ecosystems. And so to me, it just seems like also a rational move, right? It's reflective of this complicated web of life that we're entangled in. But, you know, I just love that it's working. So I wrote this essay, the original draft in 2016, I followed up and updated it for this book, and I just love that this this community in Pennsylvania is managing to win by taking this really bold approach.
Right. No, that's great. It's another part I have highlighted in hot pink. The citizens of Grant Township, meanwhile, seized new privileges, private laws, for themselves, whether God intended them or not. In early 2016, they took the dramatic step of legalizing civil disobedience undertaken to prevent the injection well. And we go, right. And again, wrapping up briefly, I hope we promise me you'll come back. Will you come back
for a full hour? I will come back. I'm ready.
Oh, that's really, really great. Because there's so many ways that this goes. And my mind is just spaced out a little bit. But yeah, the toxic mimic, we want to inhale back that dynamic, and it also goes to the proposal to move the voting age to 16, which you make an ardent case for. Of course, it was voted down, but what a good idea that 16-year-olds actually show up more than 18-year-olds, and that's your chapter on whatever it is, composting the gerontocracy. I'm not sure what the word was, but going, yes, there's Greta Thunberg, and we like old beings like the show, for instance, you know, but point well taken, you know, experiment. And, you know, if even though moving the voting age to 16 didn't pass, but it's you're spiraling it into public discourse, and that's what we want to have.
Mm-hmm. Right. And this is the thing, is that, you know, states have the ability to set their own voter laws, right? We're seeing that right now as the Republicans initiate hundreds of voter suppression laws at the state level. But states could lower the voting age, you know, to 16. And we see teenagers right now, and it's been this way, you know, we saw this in the civil rights era, right? It was children who desegregated schools, right? Kids fought for racial justice and were at the forefront of that movement. And we see kids today fighting the gun lobby, striking for the climate, you know, pushing the envelope in terms of gender identity and the ability to, you know, live as who you are and want to be. So I just think, you know, there's so many reasons for there's so many reasons to challenge the arbitrariety that, well, people should be full political subjects at the age of 18. Just like there are many reasons to challenge the idea that only human beings can be political subjects. You know, so I think my vision of democracy is, you know, as I said, is that it's always expanding and transforming. And who are we to think we're at the end of history and that we just need to sort of perfect the system we've got? You know, I think we'll look back, and my dream is that we'll look back at this period and see it as a democratic dark age.
Right, but from the compost of the democratic dark age, you know, arising, you know, actual,
yes, exactly.
Yeah, and I like, you know, democratic animism for all beings, right, and biomimicry rather than looting nature, borrow her ingenious recipes, and on and on and on. So, all right, so I yearn to speak with you further, as does everybody in the listening audience. Thank you so much, Astra Taylor, and I will now cahoot with wonderful Chris Welsh, and we will raise $2,000. Yes, we will. Thank you so much,
good
Astra.
Good luck.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much. All right. Oh, Chris Welsh, are you there? You adorable person.
Yes. What a wonderful conversation. Oh, I love this person.
I love her. She's one of my favorite liberating lucidity guides. And again, inspiring. That's what we hear on this station.
Indeed.
In which one goes, ooh, how smart, how discerning, how complex, how nuanced, how dedicated. I want to be more like that. I do. So it's a great book, you know, but we're also offering many great things. And that was, but to our beautiful audience, right?
Yes.
And to the many people who have pledged already, I just want to thank you, because it's like another great guest, Caroline, says Sally in Venice pledging.
Oh, yes.
One time.
Oh, no.
$100. Thank you so much.
Thank yous here, people. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really pretty good. All right, so we have we want to make $1,600 more right now. For starters, in the early days when people at KPFA were like, an astrology show, what the hell is that?
You know. Yeah, and I remember those.
Well, Jim Bennett, and wonderful Stephanie Hendricks came up and said, you made believers out of them today, because we raised $5,000, the first fund drive show of the Visionary Actress show, and they were like, whoa, I guess this is all right.
The bottom
so
line.
So we have a hum. We just want to encourage everybody. We have a match.
Yes.
Generously. Oh, yes.
It's for $700.
Yeah, let's go.
It says here, from Valerie in Oregon, McMinnville,
Oregon.
And Lee from Santa Cruz.
Yes.
So together they've put up $700 to challenge other listeners to Caroline's program, other aficionados, to call or donate online, wherever, however, whatever, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-KPFA, and online at kpfa.org. And we're going to end this fund drive tomorrow. And the thing is, what we've got so far, we're $110,000 short of our goal. So,
that's why. Yes, that's right. I also, our adorable Laura, our guide, says, focus right now. We want to reach this thing. Try $2,000 for your hour. And I'm, I've lost the crucial piece of paper. I'm so sorry, Laura. But she said, she's pitching especially, do you have it in front of you?
Well,
she's pitching especially... the high priced things to pledge for it.
Oh well,
help me, Chris.
Oh yeah. No. There's some incredible. My favorite thing, I've got to say, is a $500 item, which would go a long way towards meeting that $700 match from Valerie from McMinnville, Oregon, and Lee from Santa Cruz. So it's a $500 boat trip, the Magical History Boat Tour. Yeah. It's going to be on Saturday, August 22nd. Tutui. Remember those guys? Tutui. Saturday, August, that was Kukla, Fran, and Ollie. Okay. August 22nd from 5 to 7:30 p.m. and hosted by Liam O'Donohue, who does a wonderful program on KPFA entitled East Bay Yesterday. So he's going to tell you all of the history and also sea creatures and buried treasures and shipwrecks. So it's going to go all over the bay. It'd be way cool. It'd be so beautiful. $500 to KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. It doesn't have endless number of tickets, obviously. It is a boat. 1-800-439-5732, $500 to KPFA at kpfa.org. And then there's the mega pack, which at the end of every fund drive, we put together everything in one big bundle, and we call it the Mega Pack, and that is yours for a $1,000 donation to KPFA, which includes two books, This Immeasurable Place, which is a cookbook and about planting and gardening at the end of civilization, and then there's the People's Guide to San Francisco Bay Area, those two books, then plus all of the virtual events that we've done thus far this year, which is such a range, I can't even tell you, from Davey D and Jeff Chang on hip hop to Martina Sabada, wonderful poet, lots and lots of stuff. And then also the emergency combo, the water filter,
yes,
and the emergency radio, solar radio, and the emergency supply kit. All of that. Everything for a $1,000 donation to KPFA, and that would really help right now. 1-800-439-5732 and online at kpfa.org.
Okay, so the lines are quiet right now. Come on, team. We have 7 minutes. Let's do this. All right, dedicated Chris Caroline, exhorting, magnetizing. Anonymous in San Francisco gave a pledge for Caroline Casey and the Visionary Activist Show. Thank you. Susan in Pacifica, I've been listening to both Caroline Casey and the Herbal Highway since they began. Thank you. Sally in Venice, another great guest. Yes, I'm repeating that because it's true. Another great guest. And we will have her back, and we have more really great guests lined up, even scheduled ahead of time for voices, again, allies. We meet allies here where we connect to organize, because the world's on fire, right? And who brought what? And that's why we also want our trickster against all odds, our experimentation is essential to democracy. You know, the more informed we are, the more effective, so... Thanks, everybody. That's good. Okay, somebody, Ben in Novato, happy 25 years on the air. That's really great.
Yay.
Art in Healdsburg, bless your heart. I love you. Let's extend rights to all vehicles on the road, especially human-powered. I'm not sure what that means. But
bicycles, but...
Yes. That's right. Yeah, it was quirky.
Well, it could be scooters. Yes. It could be, what do you call those things, those boards that they
Oh wait, back to bad. Work, Chris. We've only, all right, so here we are.
I wanted to say something about sort of connected to what your guest was talking about, Astrid Taylor was talking about, which is Obi Kaufman's beautiful
yes.
books with his beautiful paintings, his watercolors. There's the State of Water, and then there's the Trees of California, the Forests of California. Absolutely brilliant pictures of every kind of, every animal, every plant. It's just amazing. He does beautiful watercolors and brilliant research. And those are yours, those books individually. The State of Water is yours for a $100 donation. And I believe the other one, the Forests of California, is yours for a $200 donation. And the two of them together in a combination is What? It says $365. There must be something wrong. There must be $102. Anyway, never mind. $1 a day will get you both of those books. Thank you.
That's great. And then Anonymous in Berkeley says, so proud and grateful to be part of CKC's community on KPFA. We are all community and pledge for animals, dogs, cats who can't, you know, they can't dial. Again, 1-800-439-5732. And also, you know, our homeless allies who listen, I hear from them, pledge for those who cannot and those who are incarcerated. May they be free. May we abolish prisons. May they be places of, you know, hardly anybody goes, but healing and introspection. And there we go. May the Dementors have a, you know, a cell with no Wi-Fi and just some holy books. There we go. So we are reinventing the world, but with full critique. I love what this station does and what this show aspires to do and all of our guests, which is critique and vision the solution. Astra Taylor is so good at that. And every chapter of her book, Remake the World, you know, Refugees from Across the Seas and Abid's journey and how complex and poignant and, yes, embracing all of our kin. It's like we're on the front line dissolving the front lines, right? No borders. Wow. Let's go big. Woof, woof. Michelle and Capitola, thank you. Dedicated, well-wishing, divisionary activist show. We're getting there, but we really need a big thing. We really need a big thing.
Yes.
Please the station to give it air to breathe and to give it, you know, money to flourish in an abundance way. Not a supplicant station of broadcasting its wonderful little arms unfurling. It's a deep dedication time now for everybody. And dedication in a manifest way. So any amount, $5, $500, $5,000, $50,000 would be a hoot. Anyway, we'll get you, you know, the telling the story thing for free, and then there's so many things that you can have as a thank you. So there's, you know, many, many beings, but let's, come on, team. We're almost on our way out, but you can still pledge 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. It would mean quite a lot. I hear from you so often. It would be really great to hear from you now in small or large, but with dedicated intention. We want to support everybody's effective dedication, right?
Amen.
That's what we're here to do. So
just to say, if you value what you hear, what we are here to do is to serve, and that's what Caroline does every week with incredible mind-opening conversations and topics and just her own personality pinging through everything to grab you
more,
somewhere that you didn't even know was
asleep. More shows on microdosing and entheogens and, you know, and more shows with guests on microdosing while they're on the show. And just, again, serious, dedicated whimsy. That's what we want.
Yeah.
Serious, dedicated whimsy. It would mean so much if you just called in right now. Any old wonderful pledge would be super great. That's right. Oh, well, we're
appreciated.
Still...
appreciated. No kidding. 1-800-439-5732. Have we come even close to our...
No, we're not even close. Oh, there's somebody coming in. It's better. It's a little more, you know, here we go. Come on, team. That's right. Thank you. Anonymous in Sebastopol gave a quirky number. You can pledge a quirky number. $37, $3,700. The last moment here. Oh...
Yes, $700 would be lovely. That is the match. We have
$700
on the line. Let's go. 1-800-439-5732.
Oh, there we go. We're on our way out. 1-800-439-5732. Oh, sorry. Thank you so much, Chris. You are an embodiment of wealth, as is Kirsten Thomas. All right. It's Caroline Casey on way out. We will reconvene next week. You can keep donating. That would be so heartening. Thank you.